Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips to the PC. It is Saturday, the 20th of August, Anno Domini 2016, and you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Michael Oden.
And at 5 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose. Kick off your shoes, don't get the blues. Here comes the news. It is the 20th of August, so those of you who are at the public market, if you find yourselves in the winter shed around stall number 44 and you see the coffee lady, Elaine, wish her an early happy birthday. Tomorrow's her birthday. Very exciting. And as you can hear, Dave is somewhere in the Midwest, one step ahead of the law. Steve is completely AOL. AOL.
Yes.
Really? AWOL. AWOL. And so it's just me and Michael, we'll be doing all of this ourselves. So give us a call, save me from myself, 585-966-JAZZ, that's 966-5299, toll free 1-800-790-0415. As expected, Windows 10 usage share growth sank after Microsoft ended the free upgrade it offered customers for the last year. According to analytics vendor StatCounter, Windows 10's week-over-week gains in the first 2 weeks of August were 0.13 and 0.15 percentage points, respectively. The increases were the smallest of any two-week span this year, with the exception of two different times in April and again in July, when Windows 10's share fell from 1 week to the next. If the remainder of August plays out the same as the first half, Windows 10 will post a one-month increase, about a third of July's and approximately a fourth of June's. StatCounter measures usage share, which is an indicator of online activity, and actually not representative of the actual number of users who are running the operating system, because there could be some people who just never go online. Judging by our listeners, that could be a significant number. The growth slowdown was about as certain as death and taxes. The expiration of the free upgrade meant consumers and businesses without volume license agreements would have to pay $110 and $200 respectively to put Windows 10 on a PC. Minus the free upgrade, growth will come from companies transitioning from Windows 7 and consumers and businesses buying new PCs equipped with Windows 10. Neither will be a factor in the short term. Although most large organizations have dabbled with Windows 10, few have begun migrating significant numbers of their devices to the OS. Those migrations are not expected to begin until the fourth quarter of this year and not peak until 2017 or even 2018. Meanwhile, new PC shipments continue to remain in an historic slump, with consumers declining to refresh their aged hardware and corporations waiting until next year to increase purchases. Microsoft's latest claim for Windows 10 was made 7 weeks ago when an executive said there were 350 million devices running the OS. Although growth has slowed, Microsoft has pledged to update that number. Last month, CEO Satya Nadella told Wall Street analysts that his company would regularly report the growth of Windows 10 monthly active devices. So, our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that is bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is Windows 10 growth screeches to a halt. And your choices are, I got mine, Jack, free. I got mine, but I paid for it. I'll get mine soon. I fear change, it makes me weep. And win what now? So far, we've got 28 votes, and win what now, of course, is half of them, followed by I got mine, Jack, and I fear change. It makes me weep. At least some of you are being honest. And, of course, I know you'll have more to say about this, so if you scroll down on the right under fascinating stuff, you'll see the forums, and the second forum in is the poll discussion, and so far at least, the top item in the poll discussion is 20 August 16, Win 10 growth screeches to a halt. And, of course, if you'd like to chit-chat about this or about dang near anything on earth, you can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415.
Yeah, Windows 7 is going to be the new XP. People are going to hang on to that thing until they absolutely can't.
Absolutely. And then they're going to start calling us and complaining, well, I can't do this, or it won't do that, or I got caught by this virus, or whatever. And the answer is going to be, okay. Yes, that happened to you because you use Windows 7. Yes. And there's not much more we can do about that. I'd like to welcome Steve Ray.
And I'm Steve Ray.
There you go. So we don't have the...
I hate construction.
Yeah, I bet you do.
They never give you enough warning. It's they should put the sign up before... the last exit before the construction. Then you could get it. It took me 35 minutes to get from Bushnell's Basin to Pittsburgh to get off the expressway.
Wow. Wow. So, yeah, the...
This lateness brought to you by the New York State Department of Transportation. The New York State Department of Transportation, you're late.
The Marsh Road 490 Reconstruction Bridge.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Fall 2017.
Wow, nice, nice. So they got a whole year of that, a year and a half almost. All right, so yeah, anyway, Windows 10, you're right, Michael. A lot of people didn't want it to begin with. They're perfectly happy with
Windows
7.
And they're
going
to want it even less now that they have to pay for it.
Well, exactly. You know, people had a chance to get it for free for a year. And Microsoft really thought, hey, our latest operating system for free, who's not going to want it? Well, apparently about a half a billion people.
And they're really shocked that sales dropped when it's no longer free.
Yeah, right. You know, the thing is that keeping up is hard because it means change. And people don't like change. Some people are afraid of change. They like to pretend they're too stupid to be able to change. They're wrong, of course. They're not stupid. They're actually pretty smart, but they like to pretend they are because it's easier than saying, I fear change. I'm a coward. And I get that. I do get that. But change is good. Change is important. It's what keeps us young or turns us old, I guess, is the other half of that. If you're going to change, you're going to change. But the reality is that the world moves on.
And Windows 10 is now three versions ahead of Windows 7.
Yeah.
We had 8.1 and 10.
Yep.
So...
And the 10 anniversary update, which is practically a fourth 10. Version.
5, yeah.
Yeah.
We say that same thing on the Mac side, too. Don't get too far behind. You don't want to get more than one or two versions behind because your security updates aren't going to come out for the old version. And we're already seeing that in Windows. The critical updates may come out. I guess the regular bugs aren't going to be fixed.
You're right. Well, here's the thing. It's like Microsoft Office. I have a problem with Microsoft Office. I can't read this particular file. It won't update. Okay, what? Tell me a little more about it. Well, I've been using Microsoft Office 2003, and my friends can't read the file. Okay, 2003. You have a calendar, right? You know that's a 13-year-old program.
But it was the, that was 2002 was the last one that didn't require activation.
Right.
So we run into a lot of people still using that.
Right.
Because they stole it from somewhere.
Right, exactly. Well, I don't need any better. Well, you do if you're going to share files with people. You know, if you don't want to pay for your Office suite, and I do get that, try LibreOffice. Try Google Docs. Try iCloud. Try Office Live. You know, there are alternatives that are free. I can't help you to use a program that's 13 years old. It's like people call up and say, well, I have FileMaker. Which version? No, just FileMaker. I think that's older than dirt.
Yeah, that's a 25-year-old program before it had a name. It was FileMaker, then FileMaker 2, Roman numeral tool.
Right.
And then it was Pro.
Right.
Version 1.
Right.
Right now we're at Pro version 15.
Right. And you know, I get it. It's easier to use what you've always had. At least I haven't gotten any calls about D-Base lately, so that's something. But the reality is that a lot of the old stuff just does not work anymore. And in particular, people call up and say, well, I just bought a new printer and it doesn't work. What's your operating system? Windows 7. Yep. It doesn't work. That is exactly correct. It does not work. When you looked on the box and it said compatible with Windows 10 and you bought it anyway, what were you thinking?
They were thinking I didn't look on the box.
Yeah, exactly.
So what we have to do, and it's annoying is for the salesperson, you have to ask them what OS they're running, and then you have to look on the box for them because they're not going to.
Exactly. And you know, people will say, well, I can't afford to upgrade. No, I get that. I absolutely get that. Believe me, I'm retired. I get it. I don't buy anything anymore. But Windows 10 was free for a year. I don't have any sympathy for somebody who can't buy Windows 10 now when they could have gotten it for free for a year. Well, it wouldn't run on my hardware. That I get. That I get. Now you get a bit of a pass. Okay? But you still, we still can't help you with Windows 7. It just doesn't work anymore. You know, I have a couple of old computers that I put Linux on. Yep. And a couple of others that I friends asked me to put Neverware on, which is a version of the Chrome OS. And so they all, you know, have brand new lives now. They work perfectly fine. They do everything people need them to do. And it gets that old hardware still running for years. But it's still change. It's still a different operating system. And you have to get used to it. And I get that. I absolutely get that. But, there's nothing much you can do about that. You got to either fall behind or change with the times. And it is what it is.
So if you never get anything new, your computer will probably still work for a while. And if you disconnect it from the internet, you probably won't get attacked by viruses and malware. There you go.
There you go.
Don't connect anything. If you don't connect anything, you'll be just fine.
Yep.
Right.
It hurts when I do that? Well, don't do that.
Exactly. And people will I think I'm doing an Uncle Dave rant. And you know, people will say, well, I only go online. No. If you go online with an unsecured operating system, you risk getting caught.
Yeah, that's the equivalent of walking through a dark alley with $100 bills hanging out of your pockets.
Well, I only do it on Tuesdays. Oh, that's right.
But I know the shout.
That's the day the bad guy. Yeah, I know the shout. Yeah. bad guys take Tuesdays off. I forgot that. You're right. You're absolutely right. Go into the alley. Knock yourself out. Except for the one guy who doesn't work Wednesdays. At any rate, the idea is that when you do go on the internet with an unsecure operating system, you are probably going to get caught by something because it is so easy to create viruses. It is so easy to create viruses. You wander around in the dark web or the deep web or whatever they're calling it this week, and there's lots of places that you can buy very inexpensively scripts. So you could be a script kiddie and create a virus or a malware or whatever you want to call it very, very easily for pennies.
And these days you don't even need to make a virus. You just have to make a sign that says they have a virus and trick them into calling the phone number.
Right, right, right. And some of them are free and some of them are pretty cheap. And you can get all kinds of stuff out there. And a lot of kids are doing it. These things are everywhere, and then all they have to do is put out an ad somewhere. And that ad will get them lots and lots of money and lots of stuff. And so it's cost-effective, you know, and that's the way it works. All right, that's kind of how that works. But it's a long and involved process to upgrade, and I do understand that. And it's a long and involved process to get new stuff, and I get that. And it's a long and involved process to understand that new stuff and to become as proficient with it as you used to be, and I understand that. But you know what? You got to do it. We're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. 20 minutes after the hour, Soundbites, member-supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, we have Larry from Rochester, New York on the line. What's up, Larry?
Good afternoon, guys. How are you all?
Peachy, how are you?
Good, doing good. I have a bit of a different question today. At our church, we'd like to archive some information, and hopefully we won't really need it for another 20 or 30 years. And I've been somewhat of a proponent of doing it digitally. Does it make sense to try to archive information digitally when you're talking several decades out?
That's really an excellent question.
Ask the Library of Congress and all their 9-track tape recorders.
Well, and that's
tape reels with no recorder to play them on.
Right. That's the issue. Any medium on which you put data like this becomes obsolete. So putting it in the cloud actually makes the most sense.
Cloud?
Up on the internet somewhere.
Yep.
Because having it there means that all you have to be able to do is get to the internet. Now, assuming that we still have an internet in 30 years, that's a good thing. The best thing I think to do is to make multiple copies.
On different media.
Have a CD, have a thumb drive, have it on the web, and have somebody at the church tasked with the job of updating to whatever new media come along.
Yeah, maybe every 5 years or so, check to see, do computers still have a USB connection? Do they still have a SATA connection? You know, and for years, we went through floppy disks, even before floppy disks, it was tape drives, and then floppy disks, and SideQuest disks, and CDs, and each one of those media have been replaced by something better, and we generally see about 10 to 15 years for typical media, floppy disks, CDs. CDs are pretty well gone because they've been replaced by DVDs, but most DVD players can also read CDs.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're seeing the transition to Blu-ray.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's also backward compatible with DVD and CD.
Okay.
And Blu-ray capacities are now pushing 100 gigs per disc. And that's usually what you see with newer technology is greater mm-hmm. storage capacity.
Okay.
As I mentioned, you know, the Library of Congress has a lot of 9-track tape that everything was digitized on in the 50s and 60s, and no one has tape players anymore. In fact, didn't you have a story, Nick, about the bank and someone had to go dig a tape reader out?
Yeah, we needed a punch card reader.
Punch card reader.
And we had taken the last punch card reader in the bank and glittered it up and put stuff on and gave it as a gag gift to somebody. And in the year 2000, we suddenly needed it, and we went and ripped it out of his office, cleaned it up, and thank heaven it read that card deck.
Okay.
But, you know, there are a couple of companies, Verbatim Ultralifes, and Archival Gold and things like that, that say the CD or DVD will last for 100 years. And so, that's the other part of the issue, which is that if you use inexpensive CDs or DVDs, they only last a few years because the substrate, you're not going to want to hear this, the substrate actually rots.
Okay.
Because it's partially an organic material.
Okay.
You're going to want to use something like the more expensive discs in order to save your data.
Okay.
Now, the other thing you have to worry about is the format of those data. Right? We just talked about...
Yeah, I guess so.
We just talked about nobody uses DBase anymore. Well, what if those data were in a DBase file? So you want to have them in multiple media. So maybe you want an Excel spreadsheet. Maybe you also want a CVS file. Maybe you also just want a text file.
Print it on papyrus and seal it in airtight plastic.
Right.
in a dark room.
Right. Etch it onto metal and shoot it into space.
Right. Well, you know, that leads me to think you can still read Shakespeare.
That's exactly right. You put it on paper.
I'm thinking,
but the original.
I'm trying to write fast here to ultimate solution, since most of this stuff is text-based anyway, it might be just to make a book, several books, and just put them away in a couple of places safe, because I know I started out with Xerox, and we had to keep things secure, and we started on these little mini tapes, and by the time I retired, I threw 100 of them away. There was no way to read it.
Yeah, I've still got zip drives
that I couldn't read it.
Yeah. But make sure you get archival paper, and if you're using an inkjet printer, get archival ink that's designed to last more than a few years.
Archival paper?
Yeah. The paper, acid-free archival paper, so the paper doesn't degrade too fast. Yeah,
okay.
Finding an original copy of Shakespeare, it's velvet gloves in a sealed room.
Right.
They've reprinted it so many times over the years. So that's, every 5 years or so, you might have to go back and reprint all this stuff.
Uh-huh.
But if you use good quality archival paper, archival inks, keep it in low light, if not dark, so that the paper doesn't degrade.
Send a copy down to the old salt mines in Retzoff.
Okay. Well, I still have my notes from my physics classes in college, and I can still read them just fine.
Yep.
And that's been 40 years ago, so...
Right. So
did you use a quill pen?
Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Well, those stone tablets don't really degrade much. The basic idea is multiple media in multiple places... And the old technologies work too.
Okay.
So I think that you're looking into the future, and God bless you for that.
Mm-hmm.
But you really need to pay attention to the fact that the technologies we have today, in 40 years, take a look at 40 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago.
I get you.
Yeah, so be prepared. Somebody at that church is going to need to say, every 5 years they're going to need to look and say, do we need to move to a new medium? And if so, what should that medium be? And if so, what format should those data be in?
Buy five new DVD players and seal them in the closet with it.
Exactly.
I just found something interesting. The life cycle and environmental engineering branch of the Naval Air Warfare Center Weapons Division did a review of archival media. Because the Navy wants to archive their media, too.
Yep.
There's something called the Millentia Media.
Okay.
Called the M-Disc. None of it suffered any data degradation. So I'm going to post this link.
Okay.
I found it on an article about a 1,000-year DVD. So this M-Disc is supposed to last 1,000 years.
Probably costs $1,000,
too. And then you have to have an M-Disc reader at the end of that, too.
Right. That's the big thing. That's why putting it out on the web might be your best bet. But again, put it in multiple places. And of course, most of this is free. You can upload a copy to Google Drive. You can upload a copy to iDrive. You can upload a copy to Live. You can upload a copy to Dropbox. And the theory is at least one of those will be around in 30 years.
And we just have to make certain we have someone who's tasked with following that, or someone's. Yeah.
Someone's tasked with following that, and somebody better know the password.
Yep. There's probably
password.
Well, all of those require a password, right?
Okay. Let me write.
Yep.
Passwords. Okay.
There's probably a historian or archivist already that archives some of the stuff, and you can add a data archivist to that too.
Okay.
Is it archivist or archivist?
Yes. It is. Yes, data. It is.
Archive. Well, I've already got a sheet full of notes here now.
Yep. Well, and of course you can always look back at the archive after.
Yeah.
Tomorrow or Monday.
I'll need your coffee for the first few minutes.
Yeah.
Well, guys, thank you. As usual, I can get good, up-to-date, and pertinent information every time I call.
Who does he think he's talking to?
Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thanks, Larry. Yeah.
You guys have a good one today.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Archiving data for an extended period, and you know what? 20 to 30 years is not really an extended period. But archiving data for an extended period is much more difficult than people think, because there's way, way too much stuff to talk about. I've said this before. I've got a Bernoulli disc, for pity's sake.
That's one reader we don't have. We have Jazz and SideQuest and Zip, but we never But we did get someone that brought in his disk and drive, and we converted it for him.
Yep.
And it still worked.
I've got a Bernoulli disk. I've got zip drives. Yep. I've got an 8-inch floppy. And I would love to see the information that's on that. But, you know, you got to remember every few years, move your data somewhere else. All my data are now in the cloud somewhere.
Yep.
And most of them are in a format that I can read later, but I have to pay attention to that. Now, you know,
we had a customer bring in DAC Easy Accounting for DOS.
Yeah.
And needed to convert it into, you know, Windows 7 and into something. And we were able to, which really shocked me.
Yep.
Because oftentimes programs don't have an export feature to export their data because they don't want you to use something else.
Right.
So frequently you have to use the new version of that same program. But if you get too far behind, we run into that with Quicken all the time. Fortunately, they've actually, Intuit's gotten a little better with that. That they usually go back to Quicken 2004 or 2005 when you get the new version. But with DEC Easy Accounting for DOS, they stopped it at, you know, 30 years ago.
Yeah, right.
So that was really tricky to get it out. I think we ended up printing reports as an ASCII file, and then and then we're able to read that ASCII file into something new.
Yep, and so you know, pay attention to your. Now you may not care about your data, right? I certainly don't care about all my data, but there are a lot of things that I'd like to have available for my my daughter at some point in the future, and so I want to be careful of how I save those. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Tom from Williamson, New York. Hi, Tom. What's up?
Hi, how you doing? I have a Windows 7 machine, and I recently bought a Seagate, I think it's called a Seagate Backup Plus Slim Drive, and so a program came with it called Seagate Dashboard, and it's basically, I believe, their backup program, and you can program it to do whatever you like. I installed it. And whenever I run Seagate Dashboard, it crashes, and Windows gives me a message that it's going to look for the solution, but it doesn't ever really find anything.
Right.
And I was playing around with it a few times, turning the machine on and off, trying to understand what was going on, and I turned off my Wi-Fi, and as soon as I turned off my Wi-Fi, the program launched and works fine.
Oh.
Sent a note to Seagate. They told me to check services, and they give me a list of services and make sure they're all set to automatic. I did that, didn't seem to help too much. Sent them another message, and they said, well, you're probably going to have to live with that, so just turn off your Wi-Fi whenever you want to do backups. And so I'm a little confused. And they talked about that the USB is interfering with the Wi-Fi, and you can't have them both on at the same time.
I don't know
if you have any ideas why that might be.
Interrupt request. Is your Wi-Fi built into the computer, or is it a USB card?
It's a laptop. It's a Toshiba laptop, so it's built in.
So it's probably connected to the USB on the inside.
Yes.
It may be the two. How many USB ports do you have on the computer?
Four. One is a USB 3.0.
You could try one of the other USB ports. To see if that helps any. What I'm guessing is happening, and what I would recommend is check for updates. And what I'm guessing is happening is when you launch the dashboard program, it's trying to check for updates itself. And if it just happens to be that USB port and the Wi-Fi are using the same USB connection, that could cause it to crash. And so by disconnecting your Wi-Fi, the program can't check for updates, and so it won't crash.
Interesting. Well, I'll try that. Of course, the computer only has one USB 3.0 port, so but I can.
But if it's a backup drive, it doesn't matter if it takes a little longer on USB 2. But if it doesn't crash, that's even better. And you could go to a different backup program like Cobian Backup or what was the other one that Dave liked? I know that Kobe. We've posted links to Cobian a few times.
Yeah. And there are, so the
even
thing,
CloneZilla, if you're doing a clone,
right. And that's understandable, but here's the thing. Clearly, you know, this thing is designed to do backup only to that local drive, but I cannot imagine that they aren't having a million people screaming. So it's got to be something to do with your particular laptop, right? The model of your laptop. So I think Steve is right. Try a different USB port. It may be that USB 2 doesn't use the same set of interrupts as USB 3. It's on a different controller card. So it may be that it works better. Beyond that, I think Steve is also right in that, and this twice in the same day, I don't even understand it, that you should look for updates not only to the dashboard program, but even more importantly, to the USB drivers for your laptop.
Oh, okay. That's a good point. I think I have the latest dashboard because I went right after that to make sure and in fact, it forces me. When I download the one off that came on the drive, it immediately goes in the web and finds a later version.
Right. So I would suggest.
I will check the USB USB drivers. Right. You
know? Right. Also, like Steve said, check try it in a different port.
Okay.
Because he's right. It's backup. If it's happening
if
in the background.
Don't mind.
No, go ahead. We may get a question, and we may ask you to hold on because we have to take a break shortly. But go ahead and ask the question.
Okay, I was on this laptop. I was running Security Tango, and this laptop has Norton 360 on it. I was in safe mode. And when I do a safe mode scan with Norton, it gives me some messages and basically just then takes off and does a full scan. And as it's scanning along, it's flashing file names, and it comes up with a one called backdoor.rustock.a, I think. And I searched that for that on Google, and it says that's a rootkit with low priority or something. So I did a bunch of other stuff trying to find it and get rid of it, and I even tried out this Malwarebytes beta thing, and nothing finds it. And everything I do says the machine is clean, clean, clean. But I don't understand why Norton just bypasses it. It flashes, it's there, and then it just keeps right on going.
Well,
so
maybe.
I don't.
What is the file name again? Backdoor.ru.what?
RUstock.a.
Can you remember what folder that's in?
I can't find it. That's what
you might have to turn on invisible files. What it may be is that that is a definition listing in Malwarebytes or one of your other programs in the Security Tangle.
No, Norton. Well, I was using Norton as the scanner.
Right, but Norton is seeing that file because that file is inside of Malwarebytes or inside of Super Andy's spyware.
Oh, I got it. Oh, okay.
So if you can find out what folder it's in, that may help you.
Okay.
Right. It also may well be a program that was removed and it left a little something behind.
Could be, yeah.
You know, because .a is not actually a file name in and of itself. Backdoor.rustock.a is indeed a backdoor trojan. It uses all kinds of rootkit tricks, right? It hides its files and it hides its registry subkeys. What you may need to do is take it to a vendor, have them remove the drive from the system, and clean it outside the machine. Because sometimes backdoor programs that boot, right, that are on the boot drive, they aggressively hide themselves from everything. And once they're running, it's hard to get them out. So if you put them in a second machine as the not boot drive, then it's easy to clean them because they aren't defending themselves.
Yeah, actually, I did that and ran it. Just ran the Security Tango with that drive plugged in as a USB drive, and it did find some other viruses. That was interesting. It found five that didn't come up before, and I got rid of those. But it still didn't find that particular folder. You know, it's kind of interesting. So,
all right, listen, we got to take a break.
That's fine. I think that answers my question on that one. So I really appreciate you guys' effort here. Thanks.
Thanks. We're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 43 minutes after the hour. We are Soundbites. This is member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More Soundbites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 47 minutes after the hour, we our sound bites. And let me call you sweetheart. An estimated 80% of Android phones contain a recently discovered vulnerability that allows attackers to terminate connections, and if the connections aren't encrypted, inject malicious code or content into the party's communications, according to researchers from mobile security firm Outlook. The flaw first appeared in version 3.6 of the Linux operating system kernel.
Look out.
What did I say?
Outlook. I think now Outlook's not a security firm, and if they were, I wouldn't trust them. Look out!
The flaw first appeared in version 3.6 of the Linux operating system kernel, which was introduced back in 2012. In a blog post published Monday, Lookout researchers said that the Linux flaw appears to have been introduced into Android version 4.4, aka KitKat, and remains present in all future versions, including the latest developer preview of Android Nougat. That tally is based on the Android install base, as reported by statistics provider Statista. And it would mean that about 1.4 billion, with a B, Android devices, or about 80% of users, are vulnerable. Vulnerability makes it possible for anyone with an internet connection to determine whether any two parties are communicating over a long-lived transport protocol, a control protocol connection, such as those that serve web mail, news feeds, or direct messages. In the event the connections aren't encrypted, attackers can then inject malicious code or content into the traffic. Even when the content is encrypted, the attacker may still be able to determine the channel exists and to terminate it. The vulnerability is classified as CVE-2016-5696. One of the more likely ways the exploit might target Android users is for them to insert JavaScript into otherwise legitimate internet traffic that isn't protected by the HTTPS cryptographic system. The JavaScript could display a message that falsely claims the user's been logged in out of her account and instruct her to re-enter her username and password. The login credentials would then be sent to the attacker. Similar injection attacks might also attempt to exploit unpatched vulnerabilities in the browser or email or chat app the targeted Android user is using. To make the attack work, the adversary must first spend about 10 seconds to determine whether or not two specific parties, say a known Android user and a web site, are connected. Then it takes about another 45 seconds or so to inject the malicious content into their traffic. So that time required probably makes it impractical to carry out opportunistic attacks that hits large numbers of people. Still, the techniques appears to be well-suited for targeted attacks in which the adversary, say a stalker or a nation-backed surveillance agency, is attempting to infect or spy on a specific individual, especially when the hacker knows some of the sites frequented by the target. A Google representative said the company engineers are already aware of the vulnerability and are taking the appropriate actions. The representative pointed out the flaw resides within vulnerable versions of the Linux kernel and is not Android-specific. The representative then went on to say that the Android security team rates the risk moderate as opposed to high or critical for many of the vulnerabilities it patches. Maintainers of the Linux kernel have already patched the vulnerability, so those of us running Linux, we're clean. It wouldn't be surprising if any fixes incorporated into a new Android release in the next month or so. The problem, of course, is that if you're using anything except the Google Nexus phone, you are at the mercy of both your carrier and the manufacturer of your phone to get system updates. Verizon is already being investigated by the government for holding back security updates from users, and we've all seen that, you know, we can be a year or two or three or four behind. You be careful. But the bottom line, if you think someone's targeting you specifically, make sure your connections are encrypted. And we've got another news story we'll talk about later about Google Duo and how that's encrypted end-to-end. So the big question is, of course, how paranoid are you? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415.
Just because I'm not paranoid doesn't mean they aren't out to get me.
Yeah, it's we all need to be careful whenever we're doing anything like this, and we're beginning to at least to think about being careful with our computers, but we're less careful about our phones. And the fact is, we use our phones nowadays much more than we use our computers.
I'm forgetting that the phone is a little computer.
That's exactly right. There's really little or no difference.
In fact, in many cases, your new phone is more powerful than your computer.
That's
with its,
exactly,
you know,
right.
What, four or five processors in the CPU and five or six in the GPU. And
I was talking to somebody about there's a company called Huawei, Huawei, and they make a number of phones. In fact, they're the number one phone vendor in the world at the moment. And they make a budget line called the Honor system, and the Honor 8 is out there now. There are things I don't like about it, but it uses an 8-core processor. 8-core processor in your phone.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's I want to say that it's overkill, but, you know.
You can play Pokemon real fast.
Well, that's the point. You know, you can do multitasking. You can do very fast graphics. You can, you know, as programs get more and more demanding of the speed and power in your system, you can do that stuff. And it's not the only one. Samsung, my phone has 8 cores in it, but it's also a much, 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 much more expensive phone than the Huawei Honor 8. So consequently, there are a lot of new hardware things that are coming out that are pretty hot. And as those become more common, we will see better antivirus, anti-malware stuff that can take advantage of those faster processors without slowing you down. Okay, our next caller is Dave from Canandaigua, New York, and we can at least get his question in, if not his answer, before we have to take a break. Dave, what's up?
Well, before I get to the question, I have an M-Disc still sitting in the box I just took delivery on.
Yeah.
Ooh.
I did a little research before I bought it. You know, I run a small business, and keeping my stuff safe.
Right.
And doing it over the Internet it has its problems, large volumes over a small pipe. But anyway, I paid a little over $200 for the drive and I think four or five 25 gig disks and one or 200 gig disks.
Yeah.
The 100 gig disks are made of a different material. So anything you read about reviews, like the Navy, their tests were on the 25 gig disks.
Uh-huh.
So it's not 100% sure that the 100 gigs are as good as.
Well,
but I bought some anyway. That's all I really know, other than also I think I read somewhere that these discs will put up with a little bit of heat as compared to a regular DVD. Not a lot, but a little bit more.
Yeah, because they're low-power devices.
Well, the fact it's the distortion of the medium that actually gets written to doesn't happen in this stuff because it's ceramic or whatever.
They were tested at between 85 and 90 degrees centigrade, which is, you know, pushing 200 degrees Fahrenheit.
Right. So it might survive a small fire
or
had it in a safe or whatever.
Or sitting in the back window of your car on a hot Rochester day.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah. So call us in 20 years and tell us if it's still readable.
Exactly.
mark your calendar.
In 1,000 years, yeah.
Yeah.
The big thing, of course, again, is storage.
Right.
Right. One of the things that they say all the time is do not store DVDs on their sides. Because if you use fairly inexpensive DVDs, they're not very strong and they start to warp.
Oh, right.
Gravity starts to pull them down. So you want to store them flat. Now, no matter how strong your DVD is, if you're going to store it for 1,000 years, you may want to store it flat.
Well, I'll be pretty flat by then, too.
Yeah, right. Right, then there comes the question of, why am I storing stuff for 1,000 years? Well, Larry, it makes sense. He's doing it for an organization, for a church.
Right, right.
The hope is that it will be there 1,000 years from now. And every organization plans to be around for 1,000 years. Individuals, generally speaking, not so much.
Right.
And I'm sure you hope your company will be around for 1,000 years.
I'm a one-man show.
It's up to society
right
to
now,
recognize my importance.
That's exactly right.
I'm 61 years old. I'm not going to build any great enterprise.
Right.
It's in the back of my house, and I have no debt, and that's where I'm staying.
There you go. But even so, you know, you want, for particularly every individual, you know, I've got photos going back for generations in my family, and all the stuff I take now is all digital. So how do you store it? Where do you store it so that future generations will be able to see those pictures?
And they have a service. The MDisc company itself has a service where you upload your pictures to them. They make a big deal. Their servers download it and write it to disk, not people, so nobody sees your photos. And so they'll make the disks for you. That's kind of neat.
That is pretty nifty, actually.
Well, I got two questions for you.
Yeah.
I use Thunderbird for my email.
Yep.
I use a POP3 from Frontier.
Yep.
And I get junk mail, and it's got bulk in rectangular brackets.
Yeah.
So I went through Thunderbird's trying to weed it out all through all their settings, and then I actually logged into Yahoo in order to try and sort it out from that side of things, and I still get junk mail with bulk in brackets, and I haven't been able to figure out where to turn that off, filter it out.
In Thunderbird, you can set filters.
I did.
And the filter says when the subject contains bulk in brackets?
Well, he wants to remove the bulk completely, which is probably added by the Yahoo server spam filter.
Right. I thought I should be able to delete it from Yahoo even sending it to me, but
that's
what Frontier thinks that their email customers, right?
Yeah, Frontier's using Yahoo as their back-end server. So somewhere in the Yahoo spam setting, preferences, options, and then spam settings, there may be a setting to mark.
But if not on Thunderbird, because I do this all the time, if things are marked as bulk, or spam or whatever. Listen, hold on. Stay on the line. We got to take a break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, Dave from Canandaigua, me, Nick Francesco, and you. 59 minutes after the hour. It's Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Greece Rochester, a public service of the Greece Central School District. Jazz 90.1.
On Instagram at WGMC Jazz 901.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 2 minutes after the hour, we are hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites, and we have Dave from Canada on the line, and we're talking about POP3 and Frontier and Thunderbird and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. Thunderbird, I don't have Thunderbird in front of me, but I use it at home, and you can set filters that are set for incoming mail, and you theoretically can say when the subject contains, not is, you got to make sure it's a subject, and you got to say it contains,
right.
Bracket, bolt, bracket, you should be able to then say it's trash or, you know, throw it in the trash immediately or whatever. I'm surprised that's not working for you, and I can't imagine why it isn't, particularly since you're using POP3, which means that it's downloading all the email to your server anyway, so you have complete control over it.
Right.
Theoretically.
Theoretically. So I'm very surprised that that's not happening, and I can't imagine why.
And I'm checking my Yahoo account. I don't have that option of adding bulk to spam messages. So I'm wondering if it's being added by the Frontier mail server before it gets to Yahoo. Is your incoming server the pop3.frontier.com?
I believe it is.
Yeah, so it's still using a Frontier named server, But and you can't log into that webmail anymore because they always forward you to Frontier. How long have you had your Frontier account?
About 2 million years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's probably being added by Frontier, and since you can't log into that Frontier server anymore, you can't change
it. Yeah, but you should be able to deal with it.
In Thunderbird, the filter itself should let you delete that or hide it.
I've got it right in front of me here, the filter. Subject contains bulk.
Yeah. Do you have it in the brackets?
I just found it.
The wrong brackets?
Well, one of them, the left bracket is correct. The other is the one shaped like gold.
There you go.
Oh, curly bracket, yeah.
Yeah. All right.
User error.
Sometimes
the
deleting
other one,
it.
I do a lot of experiments, and sometimes I do something I shouldn't have or make a mess out of something. So if I have to redo my system, I don't mind reinstalling Windows, but all the applications that go with it.
Yeah.
So I've been looking at stuff like NT Lite, and there's a million of them out there.
Yeah.
I just wondered if you guys had any particular program that handled all that stuff and did updates as well as the unattended installs and things like that.
I don't use Windows anymore. So
yeah.
I have looked at NT Lite, but I haven't really played with it much at all. The problem with programs like NT Lite is they're useful only as long as they stay upgraded.
Right.
Right, because they're not from Microsoft.
Right.
So you have, and of course, they're not as useful for moving from one machine to another or for moving from one version of an operating system to another because
right, you would have to update all your applications
right.
if they won't run in the new OS.
Right, right.
Right.
So for those of you who don't know, Windows NT Lite is a program that it integrates your updates and your drivers and setups and all that stuff into a machine. It's basically a deployment tool. It's a pretty cool product, but it has caveats. So if you don't really know what you're doing, don't use it. But obviously, it sounds like Dave does know what he's doing.
I only make it sound like I know what I'm doing. If I really knew what I was doing, I wouldn't need to reinstall my system, would I?
Well, yes
no,
and no.
It's Windows. You have to do that anyway.
Right.
Well, that's what I figure. It's kind of like going to the dentist. You know, you got to clean it out every 6 months.
That's exactly right. So NT Lite is a pretty decent program, and it's just as good as most of the others. As long as you know what you're doing and you pay attention to the limitations, you'll be fine.
Well, that's it from the headquarters out here at Gaia's armpit. So. Stay cool, gentlemen. Thanks.
Have fun.
You too.
The basic idea behind a product like NT Lite is that, as Dave said, you know, you can reinstall, but having to then add back all your other stuff can be quite annoying, and a program like NT Lite will kind of automate that for you. And that's pretty cool. So back to the phones. Our next caller is Steve from Greece, New York. Hi, Steve. What's up?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I have a... it just bugs me. I can't get this to work. Anyway, I generally use Chrome.
Yeah.
And I am one of those backspace people when I want to go to the previous page.
Yeah.
And if I'm using my mouse and use the back button... it works fine. If I use the backspace key, it doesn't work, and it used to. It used to work all the time. I've done it for years. Now, the backspace key does work in Mozilla, and it does work in whatever the Windows thing is called now, Windows browser. It works in both of those buttons, browsers, but isn't working in Chrome.
Yes, that is true, and there is an extension for Chrome that fixes that.
Okay.
So Google has said, no, it's not supposed to do that. Backspace is supposed to delete the previous character.
Right, and the backspace, there's an alt or control or something backspace that does that. But there is a Chrome extension.
All right, I'm up for extensions.
It's called Go Back with Backspace.
Okay. Okay, that sounds very self-descriptive.
Yep. Exactly.
The one headline I found says, this extension restores the Backspace key to its former glory.
Exactly. So all you need to do is go into the web store.
Yep.
Right, and search for it and find it and install it, and it may want you to reboot, but I don't think it does, a restart. Chrome, but I don't think it does.
They changed that in Chrome version 52.
Right. So it should work. It should work back to the old behavior.
Excellent. Now, is there an equivalent in Chromebook?
Chromebook is Chrome.
Wow, okay.
Right? So if it's a Chrome extension, and so it will work in Chromebooks as well.
All right. See, you guys got all this stuff. It's so frustrating. I keep hitting the backspace key, and it's not doing anything.
And now you'll once again be backspace retro.
Yeah, it's such a great. I don't move my mouse to an arrow. I just hit backspace.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, okay. Thanks a lot, guys.
Yep. Have fun.
Yep. Bye bye.
That's one of the big differences we see in arguments between the Mac keyboards and the PC keyboards. The Mac has a delete key, which deletes the previous character. Windows generally has a backspace key,
yep,
which deletes the previous character.
Right.
So they do the same thing, but their names are different. And technically, their functions are different. You want to delete the previous character, or you want to delete the next character?
Yeah, and to Windows people and to Linux people, delete is the next character.
Yeah.
Backspace is the previous character.
Yep.
And you can get that, of course, with, I think it's Alt or Control or Shift or something.
Same thing
something
on the Mac. Option Delete will delete.
Right. And there's actually a way.
Now, on the very old teletypes I used to use, there was a key called Rub Out, which basically did what your typewriter did. It backed up. It typed a space to eliminate the character, and then it backed up again.
Right.
So when we had self-correcting typewriters where you hit the delete previous character, that's what it would do. It would move the character back one, and then it would type a white rip, you know, white out, and then move back again so you could type the right character.
Right, exactly.
It just does it so fast you don't notice that happening.
Right.
But on our 110 baud, PDP-8, I could watch that key back and forth. We used to like to hitting the robot key and watching the cursor go nuts.
Yep. Yep. That's interesting. Theoretically, this is supposed to do. Of course, there's back and forward buttons on a Chromebook anyway. Up on the top, there are keys next to the reload key. In between escape and reload, there's a back and forward button. Where the F keys are on a regular keyboard. So that's easy enough to use without having to add those in, but if you're on Chrome itself, I don't think that F1 and F2 do that, or F3 and F4, or whatever they are. But so you can do whatever you need to do in terms of that. But it's a different thing, right? So if you're on your desktop and you've got backspace working, then to have to remember to do an entirely different thing on the back and forward buttons is.
Steve from Greece is back on the line.
Steve, welcome back. What did we miss?
Well, I missed you guys. It's just been such a long time.
It's bleak for us, too, Steve. What's up?
You said the name was Go Back with Backspace?
Yeah.
It's not in the store, in the Chrome store.
I just posted a link to it. Maybe.
Wow.
Go Back with Backspace, yeah.
Yeah.
So with spaces between the words.
Right. Okay.
There's a link on our website that takes you to the web store and the actual product.
Well, I'm glad you did that, because I'm at the web store and I can't get it to come up. Thank you. I'll use your link.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Bye. Yep. Bye.
And apparently, this is from Google itself, not a third party. That's interesting. So they take the feature out, but then make an extension so you can put it back.
Well, yeah, it's they're Google.
Yeah.
Right. So everything is experimental to begin with. Everything is a beta. And if enough people complain, and I'm sure there's one guy on the team somewhere who said, well, this is junk, I'm going to put this back, wrote his own extension. Google said, yeah, sure, put it out there. Why not? You know, the guy who wrote Gmail, who, by the way, is from Rochester, mm-hmm. by the way. Gmail was one of the what is it? They don't call it 5%. What do they call it? The one-fifth project. I don't know. But the deal is that you can spend 4 days working on Google stuff and 1 day working on your own stuff as long as it has some bearing to Google. And Gmail was one of those products. And probably this extension was too.
Yep.
Somebody on a Tuesday thought, well, this is stupid. And so on Friday, they just said, I'm going to make this. And now it's out in the store. So, but yeah, one of the problems that the store has, and this is so ironic because how does Google make most of their money? Oh, wait, search. But the store has an issue with search. Sometimes you cannot find stuff that you are looking for.
A search query company can't create a search query for their own product.
Thank you. It's very weird, and I don't understand how that happens, but it does. We've seen it far more than once where there are things that I have in the store. Now, sometimes a name changes, and I do understand that. But sometimes I have something running on one machine. I wanted to add, before Google had the, make them all look alike across platforms, I wanted to put that same thing on another machine, and I can't find it. Excuse me, but shouldn't that, if I can see the name in front of me for this extension, and this is the name,
right?
Shouldn't I then be able, now whenever I add an extension or whenever I change a theme or do any of that stuff, I bookmark it.
Yeah. All right. You're a search company.
Yeah.
Well, you should, this should be, this stuff should be built in automatically.
Thank you.
Yep. One of the problems that these stores have, and the Apple App Store suffer the same issue, is that a lot of copycat authors will come out with very similar names.
Right.
And so it's very hard to find, the one program you're looking for when there's 100 programs that have the same name. And I've seen programs, there's a text, internet texting program, before Google Hangouts started doing it all, to do texting from your non-cell phone. And the name of it was like, text, landline, chat, cell, comma, this, that, left elbow, 42. Yeah. Just so anyone searching for anything could find that one program.
Right.
But it means when you're searching for any texting program or any, landline, any other type of program, that one's going to come up too.
Right. speaking of which, that should probably lead us to talk a little bit about Duo. Google has launched its video chatting app called Duo. It represents Google's response to other popular video calling options, including Apple's FaceTime, Microsoft Skype, Facebook's Messenger. It's not that different from the other video chatting services, except that it gives users a glimpse at who's making the call, helping people decide whether to answer or not. Google says it's calling the feature Knock Knock. So when somebody calls, you actually see them before you answer, so you know who's calling.
Rather than just their name.
Right. The new app, which was originally announced in May, has been released as a free service for phones running Android, Google's Android operating system, as well as Apple iPhones. So it is cross-platform. One of the things that people don't like about FaceTime is that it is Apple only.
Yeah.
And this now is across platforms. And there's chocolate somewhere on this table, and it's making me a little crazy. Calls, the other really good thing, calls are encrypted. And video resolution changes depending on the speed of your connection. So you always have the best possible, at least, video. And like FaceTime on iOS, Duo only requires a person's phone number to connect. So if you have them in your contact list and you both have Duo, you can chat right through that. Many other services require both people to have account logins, things like that. Google's been offering video calling through Hangouts, of course, since 2013, but the company's now tailoring that service for business meetings. It won't plug the new video chat service into it. Duo is being billed as a simpler, more reliable way to see friends and family as you talk to them. The app is rolling out worldwide right now, so you're probably able to download and install it. It's the first of two new mobile apps that Google has planned for the next few months. They're also planning to unveil a new messaging app called Allo, A-L-L-O. It's an Allo featuring a robotic assistant that will suggest automated responses to text. That includes commenting on pictures sent by friends thanks to its use of image recognition algorithms, which we see in photo all the time, Google Photo. Google announced a conversation-based tool, Google Assistant, to control smartphones, smartwatches, and other devices earlier this year. It can be used to find information, play media, and carry out tasks via chat between the user and the software. The firm also announced a voice-activated device with a built-in speaker called Google Home to deliver the tech to living rooms. So are you ready for a Google-centric world? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and all of you. It's 20 minutes after the hour. It's Soundbites. It's member-supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more Soundbites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
Still waiting for that Dave Enright.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have what?
Well, so before that, I want to go back to the Google Duo for just for a second. It's yet another video chat program that's incompatible with every other video chat program.
Right.
You remember the olden days of text chats when there was Adium? And Adium would talk to AOL and Yahoo and Windows and Google and AIM and ICQ and XMP and iChat. And
right.
One program would talk to every single chat.
Because they all used, what was it, XXMP or XX?
Well, yeah, XMPP was one of the later standards that finally came out. But we don't have that in the video chat world. And each company is trying to silo themselves. At least we're seeing most of the messenger systems, except Apple's, works on other platforms.
Right.
So, you know, you don't have to. So now, if you want to call somebody, I ran into this with a guy I know. You want to call him, you got to dial this, you know, have this app. You want to call this person, you got to have that app. So suddenly you got 20 video chat apps on your device to make sure you can call everyone you want to.
Right. The other thing is, there's three things I like about Duo. The first is it's encrypted.
By default.
And I like that a lot. The second thing is you only need a phone number. You don't need like a Google Plus ID or any of that other nonsense. And the third thing is that it changes its...
I can call you.
Call me. Not right now. Wiseacre. And the third thing is that it'll change its resolution depending on the quality of your... So unlike dropping a call or it suddenly... You know, start skipping and everything else. You may get a lesser quality video, but it works.
Yep.
And that's nice. Also, before we get back to the phones, and I know we got somebody waiting, I should tell you that, and this surprises me, the most popular item on Android on the Google App Store is Facebook Messenger. Up until this week, the second most popular was Pokemon Go.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's Google Duo.
Yep.
That's kind of amazing to me. That it's edge. Of course, I guess everybody on Earth has Pokemon Go already. I get that, I suppose. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Brian, who's patiently waiting in Pavilion, New York. What's up, Brian?
We have nothing better to do in Pavilion anyway. So.
Yeah. That's Brian really said that, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. Direct your problems and questions to him.
Actually, I don't have a problem with like Google not being able to search itself because it kind of makes them human almost. You know, it kind of like shows that, well, you know, we might appear to be like this big giant and, you know, impenetrably perfect entity, but you know what? We're still human.
So. We're still human.
But anyway, I'm almost completely done migrating to Linux. It's been working out very well. And one thing I'm running into, and I'm sure you guys, probably even Steve would probably know more about this than I would, Trying to get my UPS software to run Java to printing labels. But Chrome and Thunderbird and all these, they just simply refuse to run Java. Wondering if you have any tips on that.
One of the problems is that since Java is such a powerful language, a lot of the web-enabled programs, like browsers, disable Java so that bad guys can't use it to write bad, you know, websites. Typically, you can go into the options somewhere and enable Java, but you often have to do it on a site-by-site basis, which may not work when you're trying to print from something because it's trying to run a local Java app. So are you talking about Java or JavaScript? That's actually...
I don't know how to answer that question because I go in there and, like especially, like, the Big Brown, it just simply refuses. I'll enable the extension, and, you know, I've Googled this extensively. Maybe it can't search itself. I don't know. But,
you're right.
I simply cannot get this thing to respond. I have to open up Explorer again.
All right. Well, and that's on Windows now.
Yes, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I have a computer that I still use because I haven't been able to migrate it for this problem.
Right.
So I still have a 7-based computer I'm using, but I'd like to get away from that as well because I certainly don't want to... I'm not a big fan of Windows anymore, so...
Right.
So, are you using the standalone UPS app or the UPS website?
I use the website. The World Ship's a little expensive. I'm not quite that league yet with my companies.
Yeah. All right, so let me ask these questions about Linux.
Sure.
Do you have... OpenOffice installed, LibreOffice.
On all the machines except for this one, yes.
There you go. One of the things that LibreOffice does is it also installs Java. But Windows doesn't come with Java installed, as Steve said. You can install it. It's called OpenJDK.
Okay.
And you can install it yourself with apt-get, you know, sudo apt-get install, sudo, I guess.
Here.
apt-get install OpenJDK and whatever the number is. I think it's 7 right now, although don't hold me to that, for God's sake. But you can install OpenJDK, and that is Java. That is Java for Linux. And and once you've done that, theoretically, you may... I don't know about the website. You may have to restart your browser. You may have to reboot. I don't know. Probably not. Unlikely with Linux, but maybe. At that point, it should find the actual Java program and run it without trouble.
Oh, and then inside the browser, you still have to enable Java on that website.
Right.
So, yes. Right.
Apparently, I'm going to go back and double check. I've been working with this for about a week, 2 weeks on it, and I only work on it when I have time, which is very rarely at work. But even if I enable the extension, it still just it won't call it. It won't print. I have to, things just insist on having Explorer. But I think I'll play this back on the archive and.
The other thing is that Linux uses a separate program, and I can't think of the name of it, to do Java-like things, but it's not actual Java.
Right.
And that may be the problem. It may be doing these Java-like things, and it's because it's not real Java, there's something in the UPS code or USPS code that's causing this to be a problem. And
right.
So if you install real Java, the OpenJDK, it should work.
Okay, very good. Yeah, they still have the best way to do multiple stickers. You can still save them out to PDF and then jump through hoops and print them that way, but then they're not formatted properly for the small printer. But that's my problem, not yours.
Yeah,
but
right.
Thank you very, very much, and you guys are doing great as per usual.
Thank you.
Right. Thanks, Ben.
Have fun.
And I found a forum at Linux Questions all about UPS WorldShip.
Well, there you go.
If you do want to run WorldShip. But yeah, we've looked into that too. You have to ship a whole lot of stuff to make it cost effective to buy WorldShip.
Yeah.
We try to get all of our vendors to pay for shipping themselves, so we don't want to do any payments on shipping.
Well, right.
But it's still nice to print the labels.
And if you do enough, shipping with them, they should be willing to do that, I would think, but who knows. But yeah, it's tough to get everything set up in an operating system that you're not terribly familiar with yet. Sorry, you were going to say something.
It's tough searching for UPS software when you mean United Parcel Service and not uninterruptible power supply. So you have to put WorldShip in your query. But then that doesn't help the caller because he was running it from the website, not from the WorldShip app.
Right. Also, if you're looking for UPS software and you don't know what it's called yet because you're looking for it, there's an issue. excuse me, I beg your pardon. I think, getting easier. These apps make it nice and easy to do that. They make it nice because they'll tell you when your products have shipped if you're willing to do that part and all that stuff. But getting them set up correctly on every operating system is a little hard, and I understand that, you know, particularly when you're just beginning to use a new operating system.
And for Peter, you know, WorldShip is Windows only, so he's got to be running it in Wine, which adds another layer of complication.
Brian, if he wants to do that, Brian.
Okay, Brian, sorry.
That's why he's running it from the website, of course. So I understand that, too. It's our friend Smiley from Rochester, New York. Hi, Smiley, what's up?
Hey, I don't know if that guy was running Linux, but I think the program you were trying to think of is Qlabels.
Oh, thanks.
That's a separate labeling program. He was running Linux, but he was trying to get print labels, shipping labels from the UPS website. But I think
Qlabel will do it.
Let's find out.
There you go. Yeah, he was doing it right from the website because he didn't want to pay for WorldShip, which is certainly fair. But Qlabel is a heck of a program. I don't honestly know if it prints UPS labels. That's an interesting question.
I don't think that's the right.
That's not it. That's an entirely other thing.
Godex Qlabel?
Yeah, I think it's Godex. I don't think. Yeah, you're in the Qt documentation. Qt is a front end for operating systems, and a good one, actually. But
I'll let you go. Leave the phone line open.
Sure.
All right. Thanks, Smiley. We appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Godex Qlabel is Windows only.
Yeah,
that's
Windows only, so it can't be that one.
So there's too many programs called Qlabel.
Well, that's part of the problem.
It's a great
it?
Shipping search.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, you know, it's all about your Google foo.
Yeah.
You know, how good is your Google?
I'm usually really good, and I'm mad at myself now.
Yeah, it's Qtlabel, that's why.
Is it Qtlabel?
Yeah. It's called Qtlabel. Steve is frantically searching Qtlabel. He's not going to lose. He's not going to lose to an operating system. In the meanwhile, I will read another news item about the new Apple iPhone 7 that's coming out. Now, let me preface everything I'm about to say with the fact that we don't actually know yet because it isn't out yet. But these are the latest leaks and rumors and stuff.
And there's probably a dozen prototypes.
Well, we talk about that in the story as well. Apple puts out a million prototypes and then picks something, and it may not be, you know, it may not have the features that you read about on some site. Put no space after QT. Right? Anyway, there's no headphone jack. By now, the whole world knows Apple's made the controversial decision to axe the world's most ubiquitous port for the new iPhone 7. But now users may not be getting the goodies they expected as compensation for this loss. A pair of leaks this week made grim reading for potential iPhone 7 buyers as Apple appears set to cut back on two innovations widely expected this year. The first bad news comes via highly reliable French website NowhereElse.fr, which has attained schematics of the iPhone 7. The schematics say the matching second speaker grill on the bottom edge of the iPhone 7, added thanks to the removal of the headphone jack, is purely cosmetic and simply houses the microphone. Apple's pulled a similar stunt before with the iPhone 4S, which also had matching dual speakers on the bottom edge. The headphone jack was at the top of the phone back then. Many predicted stereo sound at the time, only to be disappointed. With the iPhone 7 innovations expected to be primarily internal, improved performance, bigger battery, incremental And incremental innovations like the dual camera that's in the iPhone 7 Plus or Pro only feature. There was one exception, the home button. After 9 years, the iPhone appeared ready to move to a Mac-inspired touch-sensitive button, which uses haptic feedback, which is one of my favorite phrases, haptic feedback. And it just means it buzzes or shakes or something when you do something, to simulate the sensation of physical touch. A fixed button would be more reliable, save physical space, and potentially enable Apple to use the touch sensitivity to add gesture support at a later date. There's no sign of that in iOS 10. Unfortunately, Elite Chassis, which is believed to be from the iPhone 7, shows the same cutouts for a physical home button just like previous models. Of course, the obvious point to make is both leaks could be off the mark. In fact, even if they're correct, Apple's known to make and test multiple iterations of each iPhone prior to settling on a design, so these could be prototype plans that have since been scrapped. That said, one could argue that it is crucial Apple sells the loss of the headphone jack as a gain overall by arguing it allows the iPhone to take new appealing steps forward. These include higher quality sound through the lightning port, more space for a bigger battery, waterproofing, and yes, stereo speakers, and an absence of a design overall, the compensation of an upgraded home button and internals. If such features get chipped away, the loss of a headphone jack in conjunction with a third year of largely unchanged external design set against the backdrop of falling sales could spell trouble and imply stagnation. Yes, sales figures will still be on the scale of trouble that most smartphone makers would die for, but it's still trouble nonetheless. In recent years, Apple product launches have had little or no surprises, with some of the negativity surrounding the iPhone 7, especially against the excitement for 2017's radical iPhone 8. Let's hope Apple does have some surprises this year. Either way, we'll all find out very soon. So are you lusting after a new iPhone? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
The rumored announcement day would be Tuesday, September 6th, Tuesday after Labor Day, with sales expected for Friday the 9th. And nobody knows for sure, as you mentioned. These are all just rumors, but that's the pattern, if it holds,
right,
that Apple has done.
And let's take a break. We'll take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 40 minutes after the hour. It's Soundbites on Members Aboard of Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites.
And I found the label printing software for Linux called G-Labels for GNU Linux. Everything I found under Q-Label was for Windows only. So Smiley, if that's what you're looking for, or
Brian,
Brian. Well, yeah, Brian was looking for it. Smiley tried to give us a name and hopefully we'll figure things out from there.
And, Steve and I just called each other on Duo. I called Steve and of course we're sitting directly next to each other. So we just, and there was sound coming over the speaker in the studio. So it was just nothing but feedback, but we can see each other. I suppose that's something.
When this wall comes up between us.
Yeah, right. Duo, you know, if you're into video chatting, again, the thing I really like about Duo is that it's encrypted end to end. And that, generally speaking, that makes me a very happy man. So,
WhatsApp has had trouble in Brazil again, just in time for the Olympics.
Yep.
Some judge ordered them to turn over unencrypted transcripts, and they say we can't, we don't have it, and so WhatsApp got shut down again in the entire country.
Right.
For 100 million WhatsApp users.
Right, and WhatsApp is also encrypted end-to-end.
Right, encrypted end-to-end, so they cannot turn over the contents of the messages. Right. WhatsApp executives have been jailed. Apparently, WhatsApp doesn't have any bank accounts in Brazil, but Facebook does. So the Brazilian courts are seizing Facebook money to pay for the fines that are being imposed until the company agrees to the court order, which they cannot agree to.
Right.
They cannot do what the court order is ordering them to,
right.
to do.
As Steve said earlier, there's about a billion apps that all, you know, essentially do the same thing.
And actually, it's a big boost in Brazil for Threema and some of the other Silent Circle, fully encrypted messaging apps, because if WhatsApp gets shut down, we can at least move to another one.
Right.
But WhatsApp is one of those popular apps. It's huge everywhere but in the U.S.
But I do personally love encrypted end-to-end. I really do.
Yep.
What's interesting is my daughter just got back from Italy, and she had WhatsApp because that doesn't use up minutes. She could do it from the hotel room in the, you know, with the thing.
Yep.
With Wi-Fi, and it works fine on my phone. My wife, who has the identical phone, it screwed up her phone like mad.
Wow.
So the minute she's having all these troubles with it, and that started when we installed WhatsApp, and then we uninstalled WhatsApp, and all the problems went away. And you know, we put Lookout on the machines and blah, 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 blah. I know it's a legit app, and I didn't have any trouble at all. So I don't know what was going on with her machine, but... with her phone, but WhatsApp runs great on my phone, runs great on her phone. It's messaging, whereas Duo is video, and it'll be like Allo, which will be messaging. The big thing about Allo, of course, is that theoretically it uses the Google Assistant, so you can set it up to automatically respond things like nice picture, love that baby, whatever, you know, whatever it all is.
And Allo can turn on end-to-end encryption on a per-conversation basis if you want it to, but then it can't look into your message and suggest things.
Right.
And one of the neat things that a lot of the messaging apps are doing is, you know, you email your buddy, you know, what do you want for dinner, you know, Chinese or pizza? And the app can put up two buttons, one says Chinese, one says pizza,
right,
to make it easier for you to answer. But to do that, it has to read your message, which means it can't be encrypted, so because Google server has to look at it first.
Right, right. So you get to make a choice for that. Particularly with video, I prefer to be encrypted. I, in general, prefer to be encrypted, so I'll be happy to just do that in terms of... text, I'm rarely having any sort of serious text conversation. It's not like I want to send somebody passwords over a text message.
And that's with Apple's iChat or Messages system, they are encrypted end-to-end, but Apple has their own key, which is part of the encryption.
Yeah, I'm not happy with that.
What that does, one of the problems that Apple has run into is that if you forget your iCloud password, all of Apple's services are encrypted under iCloud, if you forget your iCloud password, you lose your stuff, period. But they have an I forgot option to be able to change your password. That means they have to be able to decrypt your stuff and re-encrypt it with the new password. So that's the choice you have to make. Do you want them to put an encryption key in case you forget your password, or do you want to lose all of your stuff if you forget your password?
Right.
And for most people, they are worried about losing their password.
Right.
And actually, the one thing we see, which is even worse, is people forget their password, so they just make a new account.
Right.
But now everything you bought under that old account is gone, and you can never get to it again, and you have to pay for all that stuff over again.
Right.
So don't, you know, if you forget your password, use the I forgot links for pretty much any service. Don't just make a new account. Part of the problem there is then you got to tell everyone your new account, if you know, especially if it's an email account. But yeah, anything you bought under the old account is gone when you make a new account.
Right, right. Okay, back to the phones. It's Carl all the way from Pottstown, PA. How are things in Pottstown, Carl?
Good. How's everything with you?
Peachy.
Great. Sorry to call so late, but I have a quick question. There are certain websites where I cannot highlight anything, so that if I wanted to highlight it and then copy and paste it, I can't do it because I can't highlight it. For example, if you could go to a certain website that I'm looking at right now, I can show you what I mean. RadioMagOnline.com. RadioMagOnline. That's RadioMagOnline.com. Now, if you go to that site and you try to select the headline of the article, or if you go to edit and then go down to select all, you'll see that the headline will not be selected. And I'm just wondering what causes that and if there's any way to get around that.
A lot of times it's because it's a picture, not text.
I see.
But I am able to select the headlines and select the texts.
Yeah,
on
so
my
am
computer.
I.
Oh, you are, because I tried it on three different web browsers. Right now I'm looking at Internet Explorer, and if I go to edit and select all, the picture is selected and some other things are selected, but the actual title of the article, which keeps changing, goes through titles 1 through 5. And
well, I'm not seeing a single article. I'm seeing a front page with a bunch of articles on it.
And I'm dragging through the text on the article, and that's letting me highlight that text.
What page are you on specifically?
Just the main page? Listen to stories
and
readers tell?
Yeah, just the main page. Just what I said, radiomagonline.com. And you know what? Something very strange has just happened.
It works.
I'm talking to you, I seem to be able to do it. So yep. I give up. I don't know. I'm sorry.
It's the guru proximity factor.
GPF.
And we're proximate by proxy.
Right, exactly. Here's the big thing with sites like this. Because the headlines are also links, you have to start just slightly off the link in order to be able to highlight it and then copy it. The problem is if you go too far off it, you're no longer on text and highlighting won't happen.
I see.
So there's a delicate balance between I'm too close and therefore I clicked on the link, and I'm too far and I can't copy the link.
Okay, great. I'll remember that.
So yeah, that's the thing. Yep. All right.
Yeah, great. Keep up the good work, guys. Thanks.
Have fun.
Bye-bye.
Always nice to be able to solve a problem by not actually doing anything
at all.
All right. Here's a headline on that page. Is Alien Ownership Advancing Broadcasting? So aliens own stations now?
I believe they mean non-country specific.
Yeah.
So in other words, if we bought a program in... if an American bought a station in France, or an Australian bought a station in Germany, or that's sort of alien. But yeah,
usually the headlines I see are alien, extraterrestrial.
Yeah,
aliens.
Well, that's what you look for. Exactly. Bigfoot and chupacabra.
The alien megastructure was back in the news. There's a star. And I found this on the Phil Plates Bad Astronomy blog.
Yeah, yeah, I know the star.
There's a star that has this weird brightening and dimming pattern.
Yeah.
And that's how we find planets, because they dim a little bit, and that's when the planet passes in front of it.
Right.
So there's this one star that has these weird patterns, and so one of the conjectures is it was an alien megastructure, you know, like a ring world.
Dyson sphere.
Well, Dyson sphere would be gone, so it'd have to be a ring world.
Right.
With shadow squares.
Right.
Yeah. On Phil Plait's blog, somebody put out a video, an astronomer put out a video of what this alien structure might look like. And he did some interesting modeling and all sorts of stuff. Now, I can't find Phil Plait's blog. It's on Slate.
He keeps moving it.
Well, he gets paid by the next company. It's on Slate now. So it's linked on my other machine, but not on this machine.
Right.
And so it's so weird. These alien megastructures, what could it be? Is it proof that there are other species out there? But if we can see them, then they can certainly see us.
Right.
And why aren't they here yet?
Right.
They are. Maybe they are.
All right. That music tells me we're done for another week. You've wasted 2 solid hours of your life with this nonsense. You'll get another chance to do it next week, though, so don't despair. I want to thank Dave. No, I don't want to thank Dave Enright at all for anything ever. I want to thank Steve. Right? I really want to thank Michael Oden, who really did amazing work for us today. I'm Nick Francesco. Don't go away. George is coming in to play the best German music you will hear all week long, and we'll be back in just 166 hours with the longest-running computer show in the known and unknown universe. It's Soundbites on the truly great and solely member-supported Jazz 90.1. See you next week.